Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. September 7th, 2015, episode number 81, Mysteries of the Universe. Greetings, one and all, and welcome to another edition of the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. My name is Kevin England. I called this episode Mysteries of the Universe because that's where I am these days with beekeeping. While I've done my fair share of research and practical beekeeping, I still feel vulnerable and lost sometimes. Almost kind of like the person who started yesterday, that anxiety and uncertainty that you get when you do beekeeping, and you're not quite sure you're heading in the right direction. Randy Oliver calls this the trough of uncertainty or something like that. And, you know, every once in a while I get into this space where I look at what I'm doing and wonder whether it's ever going to work. But, you know, we'll just keep going. It's Labor Day Monday, early in the morning, just got up, walked downstairs, grabbed a cup of coffee, came down and sat behind the microphone. I have some ambitious plans today. I'm going to detail my truck, literally, inside and out. And when I clean the truck, I really do clean it. It hasn't been done in 2 years, and it really needs to be cleaned. I'm going to feed my bees today. And I didn't get to watch the NASCAR race last night, so I'm going to try a little bit of that. But the first thing I wanted to do this morning, it's been on my mind, is get down here and record this podcast. And I have a ton of things to talk about. A number of topics. Let's see what we got on the deck today. Two queen tower hives. That's an interesting conversation. An editorial about calling off the bee apocalypse in the United States, fleas and bees, the golden digger wasp, a recap of Seattle beekeeping notions, balsamic honey vinaigrette, hoverflies, or sweat bees, however you want to call it, and the buzz is building over the other bee. I'll explain what that means somewhere along the mission. Somewhere along the lines. Yeah, I got bumble mouth today, so you'll have to bear with me. But we'll get through this episode and we'll have a good time doing it. As always, let's get started with the local hive report. By the way, it's so good to be behind the microphone again. It's been a long, long time. Time for the local hive report. This episode has mixed reviews. It's been a while since we've checked in with you. I'll start with a local yard. And I have to say, going on vacation to Seattle and then doing some other things afterwards where the weekends were tied up and going away post-Seattle have really done quite a disservice to my bees. You would think the notion that you could just leave them in the box and they would fend for themselves works well, but here in New Jersey, especially this year, we talk about July being a dearth. It has been a dearth and then some. All of the plants are shut down. The ground is brown. There's really nothing to forage on. And to top it off, we haven't had any rain to speak of. I think maybe one rainstorm in all of July and August. And everything is brown. The creek out front, which runs all year long, has literally dried up. And even when that happens, which I've seen on occasion since I've lived here, typically there's a large puddle. And the puddle is down to literally that, a teeny tiny puddle. All the fish that live in there are gone. It's a very dry year, and there's nothing out there. So how does that impact our bees? Well, three hives on the personal property. One of them was a top bar hive. I use the term was because I think the thing's pretty much shot. We collected a swarm in early July and put it in there, and I had been feeding it leading up to July vacation. Unfortunately, without anything to care for it while I was gone, it pretty much dwindled. They have no resources, so the queen shut down. There's no brood. There's a small amount of bees. And there's nothing stored in the hive. It's pretty much empty. They go out every day, get whatever they can, and bring it back, but they've dwindled down to a very small amount. Such is the prospect of this hive as a swarm. How do you say this? If they had left and gone out to nature and found a tree, chances are they probably would have suffered the same fate. Maybe the forage situation from my local yard is a little bit less than where they would have ended up, but the only way this hive would survive like a nuke-style hive is to be fed all summer. I will continue to try and feed it and see what I can do with it, but getting it to a point where it's going to overwinter is going to be a difficult task. My frustration lies with the fact that, once again, I really wanted to get this top bar hive going. And I think the only way that's going to work is to put something in it in the beginning of spring and get it to build out. Thinking of the mentoring yards for the Northwest Club, we did that. And the top bar hive up there is pretty weak, I would guess, at this point. But it's going to survive because it had the spring to build and get its resources in order and get its colony up and running. Two other hives on the local yard, both of them were pretty big hives. First one was great. It had two deeps and a medium, had a good spring, really loaded itself. It had three mediums full of honey. We took one medium off and harvested some honey, so it did get some this year. And that hive is still doing pretty well. The two mediums that they had on top of the brood chamber, which was a deep, a medium, and a deep, have dwindled to one medium, but they still have some honey to speak of. It's capped honey. So that hive has full of bees, and it's hanging in there. We're about to enter into the fall nectar flow here. We start to see the goldenrod turn up in some areas of our township. And I've seen something going. Unfortunately, though, all that stuff is going to be very dry this year, if anything. They might be able to find the pollen and whatever they need, but I don't think they're going to get a lot of moisture. So hive number one is doing okay. Hive number two was two deeps, a full two mediums. When we left for vacation, I took a couple frames, three, maybe four, out of that top medium. And in turn, I had been feeding this hive a little bit because I felt it was heavy enough, but getting a little bit light, and I wanted to make sure they had a little something to tide them over. When we came back from vacation, this hive had dwindled considerably. And I wasn't quite sure why, but I was in a let them be mode, so I didn't do anything with them. And lesson learned, that's to my detriment. Apparently the queen went south in hive number two. And when I broke it down to see what was going on, when I felt it getting lighter and lighter, it turns out that there was no queen in there. Between the bottom brood box and the top brood box, I found queen cells, and they're building themselves a new queen right now, and there's no brood, and there's no anything going on in there. The chances of this box requeening and making itself go were possible, except the fact that I think the first hive robbed it out. So now there's no honey in there, there's no stores, there's a small number of bees, and I'll do what I can to prop this hive up, but I'm not quite sure what its future is going to be. Pretty frustrating considering it was a strong hive. And I'm not knocking the let them be strategy, but one of the things I was doing this year was not going in my hives. I really just wanted to let them go. And unfortunately, without a queen, this is the fate of these type of hives. So, damned if you do, damned if you don't, right? We'll keep plugging away on these three hives and see what we get out of them, but I suspect that hive number one's probably going to be the only one viable to go into winter. I've heard this story, obviously, across the Beekeepers Association, a lot of people suffering difficulties with little to no forage and water out there these days. A lot of hives are under quite a bit of stress. for hive number one and two, not the top bar hive, I looked in, was going to do mite checks. I really wanted to get to this before I went on vacation, but I didn't get a chance. I literally was doing activities right up until the morning that we left, just trying to get stuff buttoned up for work and other things. So when I got back, instead of doing mite checks, I just put Apivar in the hives. It's not the way I want to do it, but at this point I can't risk losing my hives. So they did get some mite treatments. And that's a local yard. Going over to the farm, some interesting developments across what occurred since I've last talked to you. The farm development somewhere in the middle. I have two hives over there in a nuke. The first hive was a swarm that I captured earlier in the year and have it in the polystyrene box. That box built out to two deeps and started to put in some honey before the nectar flow came, and I continued to feed it up until we left. It was doing okay, but when I go over there now, I know that it's pretty light and needs to continue to be fed. And I did, too, put some Apivar strips in there, well, only in the top box. So remember the notion of the frame game, where if you mix match frames with different boxes, you get bad results? In the case of the polystyrene hive, one of the things that I've learned with this hive is, for whatever reason, the frames that you use very, very much matter. I bought a bunch of frames from Brushy Mountain and put them inside this box, and my challenge lies with the fact that they hang too low in this box. Something's wrong with the way they work. I don't know if they have half-inch tabs and they're supposed to have three-quarter-inch tabs or whatever the height is, but the top box hangs too low over the bottom box and they glue them together. So when you try to pry the top box off of the two deeps, it's stuck to the boxes on the bottom. Now picture me trying to get the two boxes apart. It was a little later in the afternoon. The bees were a little testy. They don't have anything to eat. And every time I pry the box apart, I could only get it about 3 inches apart. And it wouldn't come any further because all the frames are stuck, are propolized together. So every time I open it in an ocean, a swarm of bees comes out and chases me out of the area. Yeah, I gave up on that notion. So at some point, I got to get Atlanta Brave. And I got to pull full suit on and go over there and pry those apart today and see what I can do about getting them fed. I believe this hive is strong enough that I can keep it going and get it overwintered, but it's a little bit dodgy. We'll see. The other hive over there started out as the package hive. And if you recall, I tried and tried and tried to get this hive all spring to build more than one box. They wouldn't do it. I had another hive over there that started from a split and also did not take off. And at some point, I cut my losses and combined the two together. The two hives were in two deep boxes, and I'm happy to report that the bottom box was full of bees. And the second box they had built across the top four, the middle four of the top box, and were building out. And this hive, too, had been feeding all year long. I'd imagine at this point that they're not having a great time of it since all the forage is gone. And on top of that, the day before we left, I went over there to top them off with gallons of sugar solution and found the feeder full of dead bees. And dead bees all around the entrance. So it turns out that somebody came in and sprayed the fields nearby. The peach orchard or whatever the other farmer is doing there sprayed and didn't tell me about it. And that common twitching bee with its tongue emerged inside the box and around on the ground means a pesticide poisoning. I've been back and went to the Hunterdon County Fair and ran into the farmer there and had a discussion with him. And he said the time corresponded from just before I left where they did bring something in. And it was, you know, no offense to them, they're farmers, but they were also beekeepers. And it just didn't dawn on them that they were bringing somebody in to take care of their peach orchard or whatever they were doing. He was extremely apologetic And I'm confident that going forward, when they're going to do anything over there, they'll let me know so I can close the bees off. I know the person who sprayed also. And when I have a chance to run across him in town, I will have a conversation with him about the fact that I have bees over there. And if he's going to put anything out, I want to know it so I can close the bees off. So, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't. Here, I found a great place to put my bees, plenty of forage for them. The goldenrod is going to be spectacular over there, and the acres of food, and it sure looks like there was a pesticide kill here for a bunch of my bees. So, yeah, just keep working on these bees, too, and see what I can do. The nucleus hive, the bottom box, is a reasonable number of bees. I put a second box on them and fed them before it went away, and it's still kind of hanging on there. This is a box I need to figure out a decision on, but I have it at my disposal. I talked to Bob Kloss at a recent meeting and discussed putting it in with his new condo or maybe putting it in a single box. Somehow, I'm going to see what I can do about overwintering this nuke. And as you could tell, it is such a mixed bag of results this year with our hives. I think I have one hive that literally is on sound footing, and all the other ones have to be propped up going into winter. Very frustrating experience. So the mysteries of the universe for beekeeping in this aspect are still going. I think what I'm going to do next year in a game plan is, while I go away, I'm literally going to tag team with some other beekeeper and see if I can get them to come over and manage my hives while I'm gone. Because the way it went, I was gone for second half of July, part of August, and away the 2 weekends that I had opportunities to do anything in August with work activities and personal activities. And since I came back from vacation, work has just been god-awful. That's the only way it can be described. Just everything that stacked up while I was gone and all the projects and whatever. It's been very stressful and ridiculous, but such is life. You know, lately it's calmed down and it's gotten a little more appropriate there, and I'll have more time. And one of the things I know is it's a difficult existence coming home after work and going out there in the yard about 6, 7, 8 o'clock when it's starting to get dark and there's no food out there. So for the rest of you, this is a time of year, especially in a dearth, where the bees become defensive. They're going to guard everything they have. And working the bees in the evening is never a great idea, but it's especially bad this time of year. If you're going to do anything, maybe you're going to feed them. Feed them from the top. Don't be opening the hives. Anytime you open it up, you're really inviting yourself in for something. And if you're in New Jersey, or dare I say the Mid-Atlantic region, because I think everybody else is in the same condition at this point, this is a time where if your stuff is brown, all your creeks are dried up, all your plants are dried up, there's nothing for them to eat. And it's imperative to take care of your bees, because now is when they start those couple of generations that will lead to be your winter bees. And if you're not propping your hive up and there's nothing out there, you're going to have a weak colony going into winter, and the results are going to be very poor. I predict that next year a lot of beekeepers are going to be buying packages and doing whatever. Hopefully that doesn't mean me too. But, you know, look, this is the story as it is in New Jersey this year. And folks, take care of your bees. Hopefully you treat it in July and August. And I think the one strategy change that I'm going to make for next year is I'm going to feed. I know that makes some people's toes curl, but July and August, I'm just going to feed and feed and feed. A beekeeping friend of mine said to me that they bought bags and bags of sugar and put them in their bathtub and filled it with water and have been feeding like crazy this time of year. And she mentioned to me that this is the time of year where you need to make sure that they have enough nectar or some sort of source so that they can make wax. And you think about that. They need food. They need water to cool the hives. They need resources to eat. But if they're raising young, they need to be able to cap off any nectar and honey that they have. They need to be able to cap off any of the brood that they're building. And without resources, they can't do these things. And this is the last stretch of warm weather that we have. Pretty soon, we're going to get into cool nights and cool days. And once it gets around 60 degrees, which is only a month away, hives won't be as operational in the fall. So I have to agree that July, August is a time frame where, depending on what you have going on in your locale, and beekeeping is local, you should really be considering feeding. Anyway, I'm rambling, so I'll stop. That's the local hive report. I get to go out this afternoon and take a look at my bees after I clean my trucks and see what's going on. So I'll be able to tell you what happened after next time. Segment number one, I want to talk about two queen tower hives. I think I've covered this notion in the past, but wanted to revisit it. Let me explain, if I can, what this is so you understand and can have a visual before we talk about the pros and cons of this. To set this up, find a pad, put two bottom boards next to each other, and on top of those two bottom boards, set four boxes side by side, two deeps, two high, and two deeps, two high, and connect them together. Then over top of them, you would do, straddling the space between the two, a series of medium hives stacked across the top with a roof over them. Now, if you envision this, one set of boxes straddling two boxes stacked alongside of each other, then you have that opening to the right and left of the boxes straddling the top hives. For those, you would put the equivalent of a migratory cover for a nuke. It's just a flat piece of board with two overhangs to keep the bees from escaping. Now, the one thing about this system is that roofing system, it leaves a gap alongside the second hive or alongside those top boxes where rain could get in, and you probably want to figure out some way to seal that off. Part of it is covered when the fact that the roof that sits on top of those mediums overhangs a little bit, so rain falling straight down will not run through that crevice. But if you're getting rain at an angle or wind is blowing or whatever, it can blow into the side box of the top mediums and go down through the crack and fall into the hive. So rain has to be addressed. So this two queen system, what's the point of it? Well, colony one is on the left, colony two is on the right hand side. And they are just that, full-fledged colonies. You could build them out in two boxes. And if need be, you could take that top stack off and build a third box underneath and make a three-deep brood chamber. And the point of this is if you can make two colonies work together, you could have a massive workforce. 30,000 to 50,000 bees in each colony. Think about the amount of labor you have at your disposal. This notion of two hives working as one has been around in beekeeping. I've seen literature back from the 60s and 70s, 80s, and into the 90s, and I saw a beekeeping article in Bee Culture as recently as 2009, and I don't particularly read that all the time, so there might be other references to this. It's been looked at by Beltsville, Maryland, the Bee Lab, and others. The way that this works, I believe, is that you put the two boxes together and let them operate. And then where they overlap, that they have the boxes sitting on top of them, you put a queen excluder. And this prevents the queen from going up into the other hive. Now, why would you do this? What's the point of it? Well, if you can get massive workforces working together, you can have a tremendous amount of honey and take advantage of the nectar flow short time periods. And what they say is when you do this, you get more honey than two hives operating independently of each other. Other than more honey, you could think of a couple advantages of this system. With two hives sitting together next to each other, you could think that they would share the heat. And it is an interesting notion about how two hives could live in coharmony. Wouldn't they compete with each other? Fact of the matter is, I've heard this all the time. I'm not a bee, so I don't know if it's absolutely true, but I'll repeat it because I believe it to be true. It's been reported so much in normal literature. The nurse bees are loyal to the queen. The forager bees are not. They will work on behalf of the colony, don't get me wrong, but if they encounter another forager, it's just another person out doing a job. Or another bee, in this case. So if you have two hives working together and they're storing, and you have hives working next to each other, they will work in harmony. Otherwise, this whole system would collapse. In this case, bees are going up into the top box and they come back down. They could choose whichever hive they want, and they would, I think, equalize each other. So losing a colony in this manner is probably non-existent. You would think that with double the resources, they would always have something to eat because they do more work and get better results out of it. They have two queens to keep them warm, and as long as they're queen right, they probably function more like one big super colony than two independent colonies, which can vary in strength and capabilities. One thing I've always believed in is if they have enough nectar and resources available to them, any colony can overcome anything. And in this case, because they're developing more resources, because they have double the workforce, they should have excess and therefore always be living with the supermarket right above them, basically tons of stores and availability of pollen and brood resources to keep going. So it seems to me this notion, I'm not sure why it doesn't take off or why others haven't tried it with more success. It's an interesting idea, and I think maybe what I want to do is propose it to our association. Could we try doing one of these? I want to do a little more research on how to set it up and why people don't do this. There must be a reason for it, but the more I look at this, the more I find an interesting aspect of doing a two-queen system like this. It doesn't require any further equipment, I don't think, and you would have to solve that roof problem, but I think that's completely doable. To quote a couple things from the findings, going back, yes, as far as 1958, one of the studies found that less equipment is required to produce a given crop of honey with two queens than a single queen. Another one showed significantly less cost, time, and equipment are required per pound of honey produced than with single queen colonies. And in a two-year study from New Zealand involving the equivalent of 296 colony years, it showed that two-queen systems consistently produced 60 to 75% more honey than a single-queen system. Average yields of two-queen colonies were 112 pounds more honey than for single-queen colonies over the 6 years observed in the one study, and 163 pounds more than the average for package colonies. And it goes on to say, no attempt was made to carry these colonies through several seasons in the study, but under the same management, they think the two-queen system would have had an additional advantage because more winter brood rearing because of larger pollen reserves. And it would seem they would have a large cache of honey available to them. So the one thing that isn't mentioned in this one document that I'm looking at here is mite management. And the reason being, the name of this thing is Two Queen System of Honeybee Colony Management, U.S. Department of Agriculture. It came out of the National Agriculture Library Division of something, I can't read it, Beltsville, Maryland. I'm assuming it has to do with bees. This particular study was done with in cooperation with the University of Wisconsin College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. And if I have it right, it was published in April of 1976. There's an additional study available, done by Dennis Van Engelsdorp, Shane Gebauer, and Robin Underwood. It's called the Modified Two-Queen System, Tower colonies allowing for easy drone brood removal for Varroa mite control. Dennis Van Engelsdorp is one of the principals in the Bee Informed Partnership and still active today in a lot of things. And there they did a study that had to do with removing capped drone brood from one of these tower hive configurations. And they're saying that by using drone brood removal, they were able to keep the daily Varroa mite drop from dramatically increasing over the summer without using chemicals and with very little effort. This one cites a Kale 1963 Hogg 1983 study where colonies are maintained with two laying queens in one hive, with the two queens kept in different boxes by placing queen excluders between them, the situation that I described earlier. And they have a photo in this one of the hive sitting on a pallet, so to speak. It said the management technique is thought to increase honeybee population and subsequently honey yield. In addition, if one of the queen dies, the colony survives without interruption in the addition of young bees. And it would stand to reason that one half of the colony would keep everything going while you could get the other colony back up and running. The finding here was really kind of focused on how to manage mites in this type of colony, and they were doing it by drone removal. And while it does conclude that the system would not likely permit beekeepers to forego alternative mite treatment methods, it would keep mite levels below the economic injury levels for a longer period of time. So in the chart, what they show is if you had a single hive and you're just not monitoring the mites of growth with doing, and I'm not sure if they were doing drone culling out of the single colony or just with the two and trying to compare the two. My guess is that's what they were doing. But what they showed and demonstrated is with two colonies together and a box of honey supers on the top, if you're culling the drone out of the two system, the lower threshold of mite growth is down by September. I could actually describe the experiment to make it a little bit easier. Think about the way that this works. When you have the tower hives, you have that piece that sticks out from the hives that are set on top of them. That's where they put the drone comb. So if you put a green drone brood frame in that area that sticks out, all you have to do is pull that small roof off and you could pull the drone frame out, cull it, and put it back in. So it was easy to manage. One of the challenges of a typical hive is you got to take all the honey mediums off to get to do any type of treatments. Now, if you think about the way this works, and in a let them be kind of style, you have two hives sitting next to each other, and you have maybe 4 to 5 frames exposed in the top box of both colonies. You could theoretically do some mite treatments without ever doing anything other than removing the roof. You could put Apivar strips in there. You could put thymol gel, things like that, and not take the hives apart. I'm not advocating never going in and inspecting your colonies, but if you got operational colonies where you're pulling it and you're finding brood, that would be the end of story. And you could make some sort of roof there. And basically you get access to 5 frames out of the 20 in those two boxes for both hives without ever having to take the tops off. It's an interesting notion and one that has me thinking, like, this would be a neat thing to discuss. We'll probably go over this with some of our members in our association and see if we can try this next year. We have a mentoring yard. Why wouldn't we? It would be a neat thing to try out and see how it works. Now, do I ever think you'll never have to take the mediums off the top? No. You know, it's like any other hive system. But the other side of it is, you take the mediums off and you have access to two hives instead of one. I could envision if you got into some huge nectar flow, how many mediums would you build across the top of the stack? The thing would be 20 boxes high type thing. You'd have to provide top entrances because you have such a huge workforce. You have to make sure that you stay on top of these bees lest they swarm if they get too crowded. And who knows, maybe the stack gets so high. I'm singing perfect praises here. Maybe the stack gets so high that the bees lose touch with the queens down below. So you'd have to manage these hives, I think. But I think you'd be willing to risk. You know, if you got into one of those nectar flows, aren't you going to take care of your honey boxes anyway? If I lived in an area where I had black locusts or something like that, where the boxes were getting filled routinely, you'd have to cycle those out. This would be a neat experiment for Charlie Ilsley. He's always playing around with different things, and he has abundant resources in his yard. And I bet, you know, he has tower hives and singles. Could you imagine if he did a double queen colony underneath, how much honey he could potentially make? Yeah, I have to keep that in note. So listen, go to our show notes, bkcorner.com or www.bkcorner.org. Either one will work. Look for the show notes for number 80 and a short tip for everybody. We list an episode guide that has the times listed for every segment of every episode, even the round tables. So you can go back and look up other articles there. Just go in and look at our show notes for every show. And if you want to send a message, have you ever tried this? I'd be curious to hear what your thoughts are. Send a note to kevin@bkcorner.org. Tower hives, give them a look. Check them out. Pretty cool. Pretty cool idea. Something neat to try. Segment number two is called Beepocalypse. This is a response to an article written by an author out of the Washington Post, Christopher Ingram, I-N-G-R-A-H-A-M, July 23rd. Came across this little ditty. It's called, or the title of the article is, Call Off the Beepocalypse, U.S. Honeybee Colonies Hit a 20-Year High. The notion of this article just tweaks me in the wrong way. It starts out, you've heard the news about honeybees, beepocalypse they've called it, Beemageddon, America's honeybees are dying, putting honey production and $15 billion worth of pollinated food crops in jeopardy. In his astute reporting and observation, he goes on to explain that there's actually more beekeepers and better resources today than there was in the days of CCD. In one particular passage really bothers me, although he does have the semblance to credit beekeepers with solving some of the problem. He's citing a 2012 working paper by Randall Tucker and Walter Thurman, pair of agricultural economists, explaining that seasonal die-offs have always been a part of beekeeping and that American beekeepers always have lost about 14%. This is the piece that really is ridiculous. So beekeepers have devised two main ways to replenish their stock. First is splitting one healthy colony into two separate colonies. Put half the bees in a new beehive, order a new queen online, around $25 or so, and voila, two healthy hives. Let's just decompose that statement. We've mentioned this before, but this is ridiculous notion that he thinks that it's a wave of the magical wand and a simple $25 and you have a working colony. You have to take a colony and split it in half. It's not in production. You're losing X percentage of bees every year, and it's not 12 or 14% anymore. It's along the lines of 30 to 50. I think commercial beekeepers have gotten better about losing less hives. They're being more judicious about how they're doing it. The other method involves simply buying a bunch of bees to replace the ones you lost. You can buy 3 pounds of packaged bees plus a queen for about $100 or so, is what the article states. And he goes on to say that this is normal routine fare, and there's really not much to complain about because of the fact that beekeepers are getting more money for pollinating crops, and the prices of honey have gone up considerably, and therefore they should be thankful. that this situation exists because economically things have gone on better. I'm paraphrasing what I perceived that he's written here, but it's absurd. It's an absurd notion. It goes back to the same commentary about losing 4 or 5 cows out of 10. Would we survive that? The fact that the beekeeper has put his sweat equity into solving the problem by splitting hives and losing costs because of the economy of having to prop up their business so that they can stay in business and feed themselves. The aggravation of reading this story. Can you tell how I feel about it? I'm going to put a link to this, and if you feel free to respond, I'm imagining this guy got hammered. I never looked at what the response was for this, but unbelievable. And it appears as I look at this today that all of the comments that were written apparently have taken down. So I've never seen a reporter get something so wrong. And there's certainly 1,000 comments to the opposite of this Washington Post article. And it just really bothers me that it got past editors. Anybody who looks at the economy of dealing with bees would look at this thing and say a high schooler could have written a more factual story. Yeah. Sorry, just had to go off for a bit. It frustrates me when, look, I've seen things to the opposite, to be fair and balanced. People have written stuff about beekeeping that's just completely over the top. Yeah, beekeepers should always look within and take some of the credit or blame, depending on what the scenario is, for how things occur. I think the USDA, the FDA, all of the government agencies, EPA, everybody has a role to play to do their best to get this on the right track. But, okay, that's enough of that. I'm going to stop before I say something I don't want to say. It just frustrates me. You could find a link to this great piece of literature available in our show notes. I suppose in fairness, by the way, I should say that he was quoting somebody else's argument on this. I don't know if he was taking it out of context. His conclusion is rising prices for fruit and nuts hardly constitute the bee apocalypse that we've all worried about. Tucker and Thurman, the Economist, called this victory for the free market. Not only was there not a failure of bee-related markets, they concluded in their paper, but they adapted quickly and effectively to changes induced by the appearance of colony collapse disorder. Yeah. Yeah, we're all better. Yep. Go read it, check it out. Segment number 3, we call this one Bee Resistance. Didn't announce this one in the opening, but this was reported August 20th, 2015 in Entomology Today. This is spectacular news. Ever a glimpse of hope we get? New York honeybees evolved resistance to disease after exposure to varroa mites. This report comes out of Ithaca, New York area, which some of you may know is where Cornell is. An international research team led by Alexander Mikheyev, professor at Okinawa Institute of Science and Technology Graduate University, OIST, in Japan, wrote a paper, the population of honeybees in the Arnot Forest appears to have generated some sort of gene resistance that could potentially be related to varroa mites. This is possible because Tom Seeley, who works in that area, is a well-known researcher, has logged some specimens from 1977 into the museum there, or into the gene pool bank, and they were able to look at the genes of the bees from back then to the bees now and have noticed some differences. Specifically, one of the things that they have called out is the adjustment in a gene related to a dopamine receptor known to control aversion learning. What is this? Hold on a second. This receptor is a gene that has been known in a different study to control the way bees groom themselves to get rid of mites by chewing them up. So how is this all possible? Let me backtrack a second here. Back in the 70s, they stored a couple bees. not a couple, they stored some bees in the museum and they're able to control the DNA here. In the article, it thinks that evolution happens over thousands or millions of years, but according to this, it's happening from generation to a generation. External forces cause certain traits to be selected and passed on to offspring to enhance their chance of survival and reproduction. By comparing bees from the same colony only a few decades apart, the team was able to see this natural selection in action. It further goes on to say that they saw things change in several different ways. First, mitochondrial DNA, the genetic material stored in cells' power plants, changed significantly from the older generation to the newer generation. The genetic material is only passed on from the mothers, so a major change indicates that the old queen bees were wiped out and there were large-scale population losses. Even so, the population still maintained a high level of genetic diversity throughout the rest of the genome, which is stored in the cell's nucleus. Genetic diversity is the raw material for evolution, and high genetic diversity increases the chance of successful adoption, or adaptation, that is. So I read that from the article, but what they're saying is they've noticed a number of changes in the actual bee from the 70s to today, and while they can't conclusively say that this is literally going to lead in mite resistance, they're looking at the specific factors, that grooming technique, and saying, yeah, that's probably a result, or could be a result of, I won't say probably, could be a result of trying to take care of chewing on mites, so to speak. The article further goes on to say that some of the bee's characteristics have changed in the actual physical makeup of the bee. They tend to be a little bit smaller, and they think that maybe they've evolved to disrupt the process of the mites reproducing and feeding on the bees. A common notion is that they typically choose drone brood because they are in longer incubation. And there are some suggestions that longer incubation is better for the mites, and smaller bees have smaller incubation times. So I've read this in the past that if you have a smaller bee, instead of it taking 21 days, it might take 19 days or 18 days. I've even heard that in some talks. So if the bees evolve to be smaller in shape and take longer or shorter periods of gestation, it could disrupt the mite reproduction track. And that's an interesting notion to discover from the genes here in these bee samples. How does this help us? Well, maybe they can look at these gene traits and use them to breed different bees or look for these breeding scenarios in other bees and say these bees are potentially going to develop into areas where they can be more mite resistant. So if you have an area of the United States for whatever reason that tends to be more mite resistant, maybe they could check those bees and see if the genes match up. And if that's the case, then you start to see where evolution is starting to take place through change of genes and different characteristics of the bees. And we're starting to see that adaptation occur that allows the bees to live better with the mites. There was a part of the talk that discussed whether or not these gene changes were from some outside influence, something like the introduction of Africanized genes into the gene pool. They don't believe that to be the case based on what they're finding. So besides these possible dopamine receptor changes that allow them to groom differently, and the fact that the bees were smaller, they did note one other thing. The wing shape has changed and is a little bit different. Not sure if that has anything to do with this, but it just goes to show, and it is a positive trait, and it has taught me something. You know, I did think that evolution of bees takes forever, and in this case, they're proving from the 70s to today, and with generation to generation, bees can adapt quickly. So maybe if we hang in here long enough as beekeepers, we'll see our bees start to evolve natural defenses against the mites. That would certainly be welcome. And it lends a little credence to the fact that if we're killing the mites in our hives, we're deterring some sort of evolution of our bees. My head hurts. I don't want to think about this. There is that argument out there, though, that if we had let them be, let them go, that they would adjust on their own, and this lends credence to that. The good news is, and the way I want to end this segment, is the fact that prior to the 1990s, this area was known as a fruitful, great area for bees. And in the 1990s, the mites arrived, and now today they have seen them emerge to be pre-mite state. So this area has compensated, apparently, and that is great news for everybody. This wraps up the segment section of the podcast. Let's go to the back of the book. We call this the roundtable section, just a smattering of different topics. First one starts with an article, which, yes, I'm going to say this, I found in the Rolling Stone magazine. How about that? The Chili Peppers band, I believe he's the bassist, Flea, has started to keep bees. He's doing this as an environmental thing for himself, and he has started a number of colonies. It goes in to talk about his reasonings behind it, which are centered on love for the insect and environmentalism. Apparently, he's going to participate in a concert December 4th with other bandmates and other persons. It's called Pathway to Paris. It aims to raise awareness about the urgency of climate action and coincides with a UN climate change conference, which takes place between November 30th and December 11th in Paris. There's been a number of photographs circling the web, including an Instagram shot of him holding a honey super covered with bees. And I just think anytime anybody, we saw something from Morgan Freeman and a couple other celebrities that get involved into beekeeping and raise awareness, it's always cool to see these things called out. And good for him. Appreciate that. I always like the Chili Peppers. They have some cool songs. So if you're not familiar with that band, go check it out. It takes a little getting used to. It has a different sound to it and a different vibe and aggression to it, but maybe you'll like it. So if you haven't heard of the Chili Peppers, go check out their stuff. They're pretty well known, so you probably have. What am I talking about? Okay, let's end that one. Round table number two, the great golden digger wasp. I was out in the backyard the other day, sitting there doing something, I don't recall what it was, and looked over and saw this wasp digging a hole. This is the time of year where a lot of the wasps, their colonies go away, and the queen digs a hole and goes into the earth. Well, I found a queen digging a hole, put my cell phone down, shot a video of it. You could check that out at our YouTube channel. This was neat. It's a pretty big bug. You know, I know beekeeping and wasps are not the same thing, but anytime you see these type of insects and learn the way they behave, it's always interesting. And as a beekeeper, you get asked about these things. I saw this thing digging a hole and whatever. So I was able to trace it back to what it was. Let me take a moment to describe what this thing looks like. It's yellow and brown in color. The one that I saw was like a golden yellow through the middle with a dark brown tail. It has a typical wasp pinched waist, and it has yellow legs, and it literally was digging a hole in the ground. It was carrying the dirt out and moving things around. Of course, having seen it, I had to go do some research and find out how it works. The females excavate long vertical main tunnels in the ground with nest cells located in short side tunnels. Most nests have 2 to 3 cells, and a female usually digs 5 or 6 nests during her few months of summer activity. Sometimes 2 females will jointly provision a single nest. The young pass the winter underground in their nest burrows before emerging as adults in the following year. So it's interesting, you had the notion of them closing their colony down and going and digging a hole and planting something. These apparently do molts. Never knew that wasps do that. You know, there's times when you get asked, well, why do you care about a wasp as a beekeeper? As a beekeeper, and trust me, having gone through 2 county fairs in the last month or so, people will ask you the craziest questions. They see these things out in nature, and because you're a beekeeper and this thing looks like a bee, they will ask you. So it always is helpful to know about these things. These things also, these particular wasps, endear themselves to gardeners. They catch grasshoppers, which commonly eat food and ornamental plants. And they aerate the soil, improve water's ability to soak into the ground with their digging, and they are pollinators. The good news is they're not aggressive. And I sat there and watched this one for a while. I put my cell phone right down on the ground and got close-up shots of it. It was funny. The dog walked up and the thing started circling, and then it flew away. And when it came back, I had already set the cell phone up to get close-ups. If you go to the YouTube channel, youtube.com/NWNJBA, and take a look, I put two videos up. One of a real time of the wasp coming out and clearing some dirt. And the other one, I shot a frame by frame slowdown using Photoshop. So you could see it come out and unload some dirt and move some around. Pretty cool little short captions, short attention span theater, folks. Check them out, youtube.com/NWNJBA. Been pretty silent on the podcast and the YouTube channel over the summer. Plan to pick this up again. Even, unfortunately, the swarm report has suffered from being too busy, and I plan to go over there and clean some things up, get some of the latest numbers posted. I think in the next, through September and October, I'll have a little bit more time to work on these things and be a little more behind the microphone, although soccer season probably starts next week. So, yep, no rest for the weary. Roundtable number three, wanted to talk about a couple encounters of beekeeping while on vacation. Always on the lookout. Went to Seattle, wandered around, bought some honey, looked for beehives and stuff. I really want to thank those who wrote in to give me some ideas of going places to take a look. Sharon had everything planned straight through. We really didn't get a chance to venture off and do a beekeeping thing. We did everything there is to do in Seattle. I think we walked 6 to 8 miles a day, if not longer, on a couple occasions. And truly, incredibly enjoyed that area of the United States. Never been out there before. And we did Seattle, all of it. The market, the tower, Seattle Center, Mount Rainier, you name it. We did it all. We crammed it all in and had a good time along the way. I wanted to call out Snoqualmie Falls. I had a good time there and found a couple things. There's a place called Salish Lodge, or Salish, S-A-L-I-S-H, Lodge and Spa. It is right near Snoqualmie, I think the name of the falls is. There they had an apiary of a bunch of different hives, and they sell their honey products and partner with other producers to make different honey products up there. They had an apiary of about a dozen hives, maybe a little bit more, set up across the road off in the distance. We had to ask where it was and walked over and took a couple shots of it. And produce a number of products and sell a number of products in the store there. One of them was a balsamic honey vinegar. And we didn't have a chance to truck stuff around there. I really would have liked to have purchased some of this. We did buy a bottle of mead, which unfortunately wasn't very good, quite frankly. Disappointed in that, but we did sample some of the local wares there. While we were driving around Seattle, we found a meadery, but of course the day that we were there was a Monday. They were closed, and we didn't get a chance to go up and sample some of the product. There were a number of wineries and other things around that region. Apparently, you can go on winery tours. Who knew? I always thought that was a California thing, but I guess it goes up in there. The one thing that we noticed is I wonder how their bees are doing, because it is ridiculously dry in Seattle. You always look at the wildfires and things that are going on in California, and everybody always talks about how Seattle is wet and it rains and rains and rains. It didn't rain a single time, and it looked like it hadn't rained for months there. Everything was dead and drying. And I guess as I start to pay attention now, I see several of these wildfires are actually in the Washington state, not literally all confined to California. So who knew? You know, we're East Coasters. We're over here in New Jersey, New York area. We don't pay attention to that much, but you learn a lot while you're out there. So Honey Ridge Farms, we saw a balsamic honey vinegar. Have to see what that is. It says made from 100% pure honey. Have never had that, so I'm going to look for that. Also saw something from a company called Spiceologist. a smoky honey habanero barbecue covering. And the ingredients were made of dried spices, which include honey granules, smoked paprika, habanero powder, brown sugar, and kosher salt. That's all that's in it. I've seen honey granules for sale in an Asian market of all places, and this is an interesting notion. You know, a lot of people cook and barbecue and do whatever with honey, but honey granules, what would you do with them? You can make a spice rub. I can imagine this would be spectacular on ribs. And of course, out there you see a bunch of different beers and breweries and things like that. One of them we saw was Pike Hive 5, a Salish Lodge and Spa hopped honey ale. We were looking for that for sale and couldn't find any. But you can go to pikebrewing.com apparently and order some of this. And it's on First Avenue in Seattle, Washington is the address for this. You know, there's only so many times and so many attention spans you could spend on different things out there. I did notice a bunch of different plants and shot some video of bees working different things out there, but I don't know what the plants are native to that region. And everywhere we went, we saw bees, which was really cool. Especially one of the trips we took over was to an island off of Puget Sound, and we went for a visit to this place where they made salmon and did a show and did whatever, and there were bees all over the place on the island there. Cool. Cool little experience we had in Seattle and got to mix in some beekeeping. I really wish we could have found a day. It was originally in the plan, but got nixed when we decided to go do something else, to go out to an apiary. And everybody was kind of up for it, but after we got a chance to get invited to something while we were out there, we chose the latter. So maybe next time, we'll see. Danny's talking about another experience out there for his next co-op, so perhaps we'll get a chance to go out and revisit the region and do it again. Roundtable number 4, hoverflies. I posted a video of that same day. I was sitting out there watching a wasp and shot that video. A bunch of different sweat bees were coming around. Ever see a sweat bee? A lot of times you feel a little tickle, you don't even know it's a sweat bee. But this one particularly landed on my hand and was licking the salt off of my finger. Now, I used the term sweat bee, and when I posted the video, I posted a video of a sweat bee, and somebody immediately wrote me back and said, "Don't you know that's not a bee? It's a hoverfly." But everybody in the world that I know of has always called them a sweat bee. They resemble a bee in shape. They're black and yellow in stripes, and they're very small, so people typically refer to them. So sometimes they're called flower flies or Cypriid flies. They're part of the Cypridae family. They're often seen hovering, as it says in the Wikipedia article, or some article that I found, nectaring at flowers. So they are an important pollinator, and I see them all over the place, including recently on the jewelweed and on other flowers. We see them often on the black-eyed Susan. They're all over the place pollinating things. So when we talk about our love for pollinators, we have to include these hoverflies. And they are an important part of that, I guess. And you think about how small they are, they must get into plants that bees cannot get into. One of the things that's said about these hoverflies is the fact that they do more pollination than bees. They may not carry as much volume of pollen on their pollen baskets or bodies or whatever it is they get into, but they make greater number of visits to flowers. And the other day we were splitting some wood in the backyard, and for whatever reason, that scent of natural wood wetness tends to bring things out, and there were hoverflies all over the place. Had to be dozens of them. One of the things they're also known for beneficially is that they eat aphids, to the joy of many gardeners. So if you ever encounter a hoverfly and call it a sweat bee, just qualify to everybody that it is a fly so you don't get called out. If you want to see what this looks like, go back to that YouTube link that I gave you, youtube.com/NWNJBA. I shot the video of the fly landing on my finger, and then every once in a while when I got a really clear image, I froze the video, and you can get a close-up of what it looks like. Or you could just
Google, Bing, Hoverfly, and look at the images. They're pretty cool. There's tons of variations of these too, by the way. So different colorations, different striations, but they do look like bees, and I like to refer to them as a sweat bee. That's what I've always known them as. Staying in the same theme, we'll go to roundtable number 5. This one is the buzz over other bees. This one comes from AlleghenyFront.org. You know, when you're out looking around, you tend to see bees, but you also see a bunch of other things, like the hoverfly that we were just talking about. I've noticed an overabundance of bumblebees this year, which is a surprise to me, because we know bumblebees are also on the decline. You can look at the gap from lack of bees and wonder if there's some other way to do it. And Penn State University is looking at how to supplement the honeybee with something that's already out there. There was an article in the Allegheny Front, has a picture of Marianne Fraser, whom we all know and appreciate. They're talking about different types of bees that are being looked at for orchards. One of them is called a job and the other one's called a bob. Job is a Japanese orchard bee, and a bob, which is out west, is called a blue orchard bee. These bees are, like the hoverfly we just talked about, a little more opportunistic in the fact that they'll go out and pollinate more and visit more plants. They could use these for probably orchards and other type of products like a squash and things like that, right? And I always wondered what it would take to breed different types of bees and potentially move them around. Sharon, for my birthday, by the way, Kevin Woman, Gary and Margaret, thank you for the call for my birthday. If you listen to the Kiwi Mana Buzz, to appreciate that this past weekend, entered into another year older. Sharon, for my birthday, bought me a small little device that I'd been talking about building a mason bee hive. And these, to me, when I look at the pictures in this article, resemble a mason beehive. They're a block of wood with a bunch of different holes, small ports built that these little bees can get in. They tend to build their nest in the back and close them off with a little bit of mud or whatever it is they cover them with. And you could potentially groom a set of orchard bees in wherever you live and then take them into an orchard and have them pollinate for you. In cooperation with, and this is key, I think, a lot of times when I read about these other pollinators that people have, people think that bees do all the work, but the fact of the matter is if you go into any particular field and you sit and observe where bees are pollinating, you see other pollinators doing some of the work too. There's certain things about that symbiotic relationship between bees and other pollinators that make pollination even better. This is why they're encouraging foragers to leave farmers to leave margins and pollinator paths in between. Some of the pollinators can't reach as widespread as a bee, but having these different areas brings diversity in pollination and you get better crops from it. If you look at watermelon, for example, and cut it in half, if the front of the neck of the watermelon is small and there's not a lot of seeds, and well, that's because it wasn't properly pollinated. If you look at a proper pollination of a watermelon, it has the seeds throughout, and the seeds are what make the watermelon sweet. Now they're breeding seedless watermelons and all these other things, but the bottom line is pollination and good pollination makes better crops, and diversity in pollinators makes a big difference. So it's pretty exciting to see that Penn State is keeping their diversity open and working with jobs and bobs and other types of pollinators and looking at that. That's pretty cool. We'll have a link to this article, AlleghenyFront.org/story/buzz-building-over-other-bees. Yeah, we'll have a link to that for you in the show notes. Before I leave the topic, I wanted to give one other note of interest there. Carly Miller is another person featured in there. She's a grad student working apparently with Marianne. Love to see other people working in this area and wanted to give her a shout out. Also see a mention of Shelby Fleischer. They're looking in on a cucumber patch at Penn State University's Research Farm in State College, Pennsylvania. And just love the fact that these folks are working on this and want to give credit where credit is due. Hopefully others involved can get notoriety for the work that they're doing on behalf of all of us. Roundtable number 6, last one for the episode. One more to go here. This one's called B-Frame Wiring Video. We came across this the other day on YouTube. It's an interesting thing. And first off, I'll say, Kevin moment. I'm not clear why people wire frames. And what I mean by this is you run that wire between the holes. You may or may not have observed this, depending on how long you've been keeping bees. When you buy a frame from a commercial manufacturing, they have holes in the side. Typically, people use those for pins to hold foundation. Other people use them to run wires across to wire the frame. And I don't think I've ever done that. I don't know why, when you have the pins and foundation, you would do it. But with the move to foundationless and with the move to wireframes and get back to our roots, this was an interesting contraption. It's a flat panel with a jig that you lay a frame into, and it has a series of spools and rollers, and you run the wire around the spools, or from the spool through the rollers and around, and secure it on the far end. And then you could pick up the slack, let go of one of the wires, pull it tight, pull it back through, and then you nail it down and you get that tightness that you want. Difficult to describe in words, easier to see in a video. Go to our show notes and pick up the link to this video on YouTube on this device. From the Gadget Garage, it's one thing we always like and appreciate Noel Hutchinson from posting this. B-Frame Wiring Video is the name of it on YouTube. You can find it. Noel Hutchinson is the person who posted the video on this. It's a frame jig that allows you to wire your frames. And I guess as long as I've been doing this, I never really looked into the notion of why you wire your frames. I'm going to have to go figure that out. I'll do that as a homework assignment. I've seen the Fat Bee Man do it. I've seen others teach how to do this manually. I don't know if it's from your own foundation, different type of foundation, no foundation, foundationless. I'm actually happy to admit that I don't know about this, and I guess I could find out more about it. But when I saw this video, I said, boy, what a cool gadget for the Gadget Garage. And I have some frames that have been wired. When I bought Nukes from one of the providers, they were wired that way. And I could see a use for the wiring in foundationless frames. So anyway, check that out in our show notes, bkcorner.com or bkcorner.org. Look for episode number 82. So an hour and 15 minutes into the episode, I guess it's time to close it down. I'll just end with a public service announcement. This is the time of the year where you get into late summer, early fall management. I would recommend to folks not to do open feeding at this time. Be very careful about robbing. It's that time of year where there's nothing out there for them to eat. This is where you want to look into your hive health, especially for your queen, as I've discussed with that one hive that I have. And if your bees are light, they need 60 to 80 pounds in the mid-Atlantic region to overwinter. So not sure what the fall flow is going to look like this year, folks, so you might want to start looking at ways to get some nectar stores into the hive. Ideally, you've saved off some honey. I didn't have excess this year, but maybe you did. You could put it back on the hives and feed it to them. The simple stuff over the year, maybe the hive has sunk in the mud, not a little off kilter, not particularly straight. Tilt your hives the correct way. I tend to think that September, October timeframe is when we start to see some hurricanes come through or heavy rains in the fall. The Harvest Fest for our local town comes up next weekend, and I promise you that the last 3 or 4 years it has monsoon rained every time we've tried to do that event. This year we're not going over there, but next weekend I can almost guarantee rain based on what the past history is going to be. This is a time of year also where you close your hives down a little bit, make sure you can prevent robbing. And if you're so inclined to do this, the practice to arrange your brood chambers down in the bottom so that they could store honey over. If you go to our YouTube channel, look for Fall Management Arranging a Hive for Overwintering, you'll see Stan Wazatowski talk about that procedure. For those of you that have the notion to get your hives winter ready by doing things above and beyond, you could start getting your tar, paper, and wind blocks and things like that set up. This is the time of year also when things start to shut down. You want to get your entrance guards ready to go. Keep the mice out of your hives. And if you have a couple weak hives, maybe you're going to consider combining them to see if you can get them to go over winter. Last but not least, hurricane blows through, something goes on, heavy winds. You don't want to lose the tops to your hives when it starts to get chilly at night. So make sure you got your weights on your covers and just have your hives in ship shape ready for some cold weather coming our way. I think that about wraps it up. It's been a while since I've been behind the microphone, but I have stuff prepped for the next episode ready to go. I've been collecting articles and stories in preparation for the next episode, so I promise you we won't have a long layoff. It'll only be a week or two. We'll be back with our next episode. A bunch of stuff going on for the club. Looking forward to the September and October meetings. They're starting to take shape for our association, and we're discussing our plans for next year as I am thinking about them for my own yards. And as usual, yeah, mysteries of the universe coming back to where we started. Gonna go out and clean my truck and think while I'm doing that therapeutic activity about what I should be doing next. Always thinking about next actions and enjoying beekeeping always on my mind. Hope everybody's doing well, has had a good summer. Back to school time is here. For those of you who have students, and we enter into the fall flow, starting to see leaves falling out of the trees in the backyard, landing in the pool, time to get that closed up. And it has been a fun and enjoyable summer. Maybe not so much for beekeeping, but you know what? We can always look forward to spring for next year, and I am anticipating those days. So with that, I guess it's time to close it down and say goodbye. If you have anything to share about what's going on, you could write in to kevin@bkcorner.org. Happy to hear from you, and I'll say, like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, everybody, and be well.